start going through our questions here. So welcome, thanks for being here, and looking forward to diving into some good case studies. And I'm going to pull up some of the questions that we've gotten. And as I'm pulling this up, I want to share just a little bit about the meditation experience that I recently had. I was at a 36-day meditation retreat, which is quite a while to be meditating, and that was really an amazing experience and one that I feel is really important in the functional medicine community to share about, because as of right now, in terms of the interventions that I believe to be some of the most impactful and helpful interventions for HPA axis dysregulation when people have adrenal issues, I believe meditation retreats to be one of the most important interventions that there are for really establishing or resetting the dysregulations that chronic stress does for the HPA axis. And so I think it's important that we understand the value of meditation retreats, even above and beyond simply a daily practice of meditation, for example. And part of what seems to be an important aspect about meditation retreats beyond, or as a difference from a vacation, have come through in some research. And some of the more recent research on meditation has shared that there's, when comparing meditation to a simple vacation, taking time off, which is one of the better comparisons to be made if we're trying to find a control, the difference is that while both lower cortisol, while both help with the adrenal hormones during the experience of vacation or the experience of meditation retreat, the big difference comes after the experience or after the meditation retreat. Because what seems to happen is that after the meditation retreat, that the changes in cortisol that had happened during the meditation retreat don't just reset back to normal, whereas with vacation, they seem to reset back to where they were prior to the vacation. So it seems like in terms of longevity and in terms of the ability to sustain and maintain the changes that are associated with having gone on a meditation retreat versus a vacation, there's a significant difference, and it does seem to be a difference that lasts and persists. And so I certainly, in my personal experience of this 36-day retreat, have found that to be true. And what specifically I've found in my own personal experience is that I feel much more resilient in the face of stress and stressors than I had previously. And that resilience is where I feel like there's a substantial difference when comparing meditation retreat to another intervention like a vacation or just relaxing or a staycation or taking time off work or other things like that. There's actual training, and that actual training is something that's really training to be able to handle more stressful periods while staying calm, while staying centered, while staying able to handle intensity or challenge or struggle. So, of course, coming back from a 36-day meditation retreat after that experience of going really, really deep and being in a loving community of people and having bonded very deeply with that community of people, jumping back into the work stress was a significant shock to the system, a significant shift. But I actually felt very smooth in that shift, even when it was coupled with a lot of intensity and some challenges and some, you know, fires that had to be put out, normal stuff that happens when taking time away from business and focusing back in. So one of the big takeaways for me was resilience in the face of stress, in the face of struggle, of having the ability to feel that it's not that big a deal and that I've been able to work through inner struggles in my own mind that have come up during intensive periods of meditation, because intensive periods of meditation tend to bring up stressors and struggles internally. And so I've really gained a lot of value from having been able to have that experience of being deep in training for meditation and then bringing that training home. So after having answered some questions, if we have some additional time, I'll dive a little deeper into some of the highlights from my experience at the 36-day meditation retreat. But for now, I'll leave you with that big overarching feeling of, I feel like there's a big reset in the HPA axis, and I believe meditation retreats to be one of the biggest, most powerful interventions. They don't have to be 36 days, even just a 5-day or 7-day or 14-day retreat can really have a big role in resetting the HPA axis. And then on top of that, I'd add that coming out of that meditation retreat and going back into day-to-day life offers a significantly different experience when compared to vacation or other relaxation activities. So now let's transition into some cases. So we're going to share screen here. So we've got a question submitted here about a female, age 56, chief complaint of fatigue. And in the November Q&A, we discussed how to get started with a client who was exposed to mold 2.5 years ago and has severe fatigue and brain fog now. Wanted to send her to get initial labs that we recommended on the last Q&A, which we recommended an HLA-DR and a TGF-beta-1. In Kansas City, it's been difficult to find referring doctors to send clients to labs that are outside of scope of practice that will in turn, you know, work together with her. So it looks like Brooks found doctors that will work with her, but not really functional medicine trained, don't understand what we're doing, or they're great but already have their own programs. She did just meet an IFM doctor that she thinks could turn into a great connection referral, but really until having these referrals in place, running into some trouble supporting clients with referring them to get the labs they needed. So, you know, do we take clients for a single distance appointment, or do we know any other options for referrals like this? And The client's a nurse, very well educated, anywhere besides direct labs where someone could order Marcoms or Multoxin markers on their own. So here is one suggestion for that, Brooke, is if you go to Life Extension, which is a supplement company, they also do labs and people can order them for themselves. You, as a nutritionist, you may be able to order a wholesale, to get on a wholesale account with them. If you are able to get on a wholesale account with them, you might be able to get a discount. But even if you can't, someone else can just go straight to lifeextension.com. They can go to blood tests, lab testing here, and they can go to, let's say, HLA-DR mold genetic testing, and they're going to pay $349. They can add it to cart, and, you know, this price could change, but that's the current pricing. They can add it to cart. If you do happen to be able to get a wholesale account, which I don't know if you can, but if you can, you'll get even an additional discount beyond this, and then you can charge this amount or whatever amount you want to the client, and they'll send you the results. But if you can't, then at least you can send people here to get this for themselves. So she could just hop on here, get the HLA-DR mold genetic testing for the HLA-DR. And then I don't know that they have TGF-beta-1 as a standalone, but they do have a biotoxin mold illness panel. So it is a little pricey at $425, but it includes MMP9, TGF-beta-1, MSH, ADH, and osmolality. So it's not ideal in that the pricing is a little bit higher than you would be able to get if you were to be able to have your own account with some place like Professional Co-op, but it is a reasonable solution for you to do to not have to deal with going through places like other functional medicine offices. So you could just recommend that someone orders straight through Life Extension as an additional or a different way to go about things versus having to go through another doctor or direct labs. So I'd recommend checking out Life Extension. See if you can set up a wholesale account for yourself and or have people direct order the HLA-DR panel and the biotoxin mold illness panel, and that'll give you a starting point. As for us in doing single sessions, we can do that. Depends on what we're doing. We have another doctor who will sometimes do just a Marcon's nasal swab. That's an in-office thing, so it wouldn't be a great solution for you, but since we can do that so quickly and we are not running anything through insurance, we can basically do a single session rate, and we don't have to do our usual full hour-long session. So we can do a half-hour session, which is $300. If it's very, very simple, we might be able to do a 15-minute session, which is $150. So if we're just doing an order, it's a once-and-done thing, and we're not answering questions for people, and we're not, you know, doing insurance or client care, then we can do that, and we can get a better rate than you would be getting or they would be getting directly on Life Extension. We can get a better rate through Professional Co-op and get the client a better rate that way. So that is an option as well if Life Extension doesn't seem to be a good solution for you, especially if you can't get a wholesale account with them. Second question, this person ordered her own Great Plains organic acid test and also, one other thing is I do believe you can create an account with Dunwoody as the nutritionist, and Dunwoody has released a biotoxin test, and that biotoxin test does include TGF-beta 1 again. If you're not able to go through insurance, the price is substantial, so you have to consider that, because some of these markers you're not going to need. But it apparently doesn't have info on the website yet. But it does have TGF-beta 1, C3, C4A, CD57. So it's like a Lyman mold hybrid panel. So I do believe you can get an account with them. I do believe you can get okay pricing on that, but it's not going to be the standalone TGF-beta 1 that you're looking for. So in the standalone TGF-beta 1, that one, I you may be best in working with us or another practitioner for. So this person ordered their own Great Plains organic acid test and toxic compound test. And so we have that, and we'll give your feedback on it. And we touched on the difference between Great Plains and Genova Organics test, but can we speak to this further? Cantor or Genova, unless you go through Direct Labs. So would we suggest Genova over Great Plains? Great Plains organic acid test is great. I don't have any qualms with it. I think it's a great test. It has some markers that I personally have researched less than the organics test, so I don't have as strong of a clinical understanding of all of the markers for the Great Plains test in the same way that I do the Genova organic acids test, with the same level of research-based scrutiny. So that is a caveat that I have to give you, that, you know, eventually I may go digging through the research on the Great Plains one, but so far what I've seen looks great on the Great Plains one, and I have no qualms with that test, and I think it's a great test, and I think if you can order it, it would be great to order it, and we'll help you with the interpretation. So we'll take a look at that, and I'm going to switch over to it now. So here we've got a glyphosate result, and of course glyphosate's that nasty compound, and it's contained in Roundup, and it's the most commonly used pesticide that's used in a lot of the genetically modified foods, and it's actually been used also in certain other things like the drying process for wheat, even non-genetically modified. So it is something to be aware of, and something that can have exposure from a couple of different sources. So when we see that glyphosate in this case is at 1.6, that's above the 50th percentile. It's getting close to the 75th percentile, which would be 1.8. And in terms of glyphosate, where I would like to see it is I'd like to see it in the lower than 50th percentile if someone has detoxification issues and toxic burden issues. So in this case, for this person, I would be seeking a source for this level of glyphosate. It wouldn't be an enormously alarming thing for me. I'm not thinking with this level of glyphosate that I'm incredibly alarmed and need to, you know, set everything else aside and just deal with this. But this is one level that I'd say, hey, this could be a contributing factor to fatigue as part of a toxic burden load with other elements to it as well. And so I would be looking at some possible sources for glyphosate in this person's diet. And so some of the things that Great Plains is saying here are useful. So they talk about it's the world's most widely used herbicide, broad spectrum, more than 700 different products from agriculture and forestry use introduced in the 70s to kill weeds, and then amplified after the introduction of genetically modified glyphosate-resistant crops. So basically, there are certain genetically modified crops where the genetic modification has been such that those crops are not affected by glyphosate, which means that the farmers can spray the crop with glyphosate, kill weeds and many, many other things, and this particular crop will be unaffected and will continue to grow. So some of the big GM, the two biggest to know about are corn and soy, because almost 90% of corn and soy that's not organic or certified non-GMO is going to be GMO. And so that's going to be potentially one of the huge sources for glyphosate. Another one to know about is wheat, because of the drying process where glyphosate can be used in that process. So in terms of what we want to ask this client based on this lab, is we want to ask how much corn, how much soy, and how much wheat are being consumed. And we may want to recommend a corn, soy, and gluten-free diet. We may allow for organic corn and soy if we know the person tolerates it and we don't have other reasons to eliminate those things. But because this person in this case has a mold issue, corn we're going to want to steer clear of anyway, because corn can be contaminated with mycotoxins, with mold toxins. The storage for grains isn't great, and in that storage there can be mold growth and mold toxins. So corn's going to be one that we're going to want to for sure steer clear of in this case. Soy we'll probably want to steer clear of unless it's non-GM or organic and we know they tolerate it and we've, you know, maybe they've done an elimination previously and reintroduced it without any ill effect. Then organic soy, fermented soy that's non-GM could be okay. Otherwise, we want to eliminate soy. And then gluten, of course, we want to eliminate for many reasons, including glyphosate. So there can be drinking water contamination as well. So we're going to want to check on water filtration. And we want to make sure that the person's using a good quality filter like a Berkey or a reverse osmosis filter of some sort. If they're using reverse osmosis, best if they have some remineralization drops or a filter that remineralizes after going through the reverse osmosis process. So that is another thing. And then, of course, want to make sure there's no environmental exposure to, you know, Roundup, which there shouldn't be, I wouldn't think in this case, but of course it's good to make sure that there's not skin contact. So those are some of the things to avoid the introduction of glyphosate. But then we have, of course, also the question of how to detoxify the toxic burden that's already accumulated. So that's actually going to be similar to what we're going to do for mold toxicity anyway. We're going to look at detoxification compounds like N-acetylcysteine that upregulate glutathione and or oral glutathione and or liposomal glutathione plus something like an NRF2 thing like a liposomal DIM as an example plus binders to bind toxin in the bile and get it out with the bile. So those are going to be some of the main things or interventions that we're going to use for that. I'm going to plug my computer in here. So next we have 2-hydroxyisobutyric acid, or 2-HIB. And so this toxic compound is one that's used, it's used as gasoline additives, and I've seen this exposure increased a lot for city dwellers. So I think that one strategy that's important to do here is for people who live in the city to be using a high quality air purifier in their home. And it's important to get fresh air flow, especially during the summer, and windows being open is good. And there's an app that people can get that can help monitor the particulate in the air, which won't directly necessarily be exactly a direct relationship or a direct measure of gasoline or vapor exhaust fume exposure, but it will give a sense for that. So the app is called Air Visual, and Air Visual will give a number rating close to where a person lives. So for example, right now on my Air Visual app, when I plug in near where I'm at, it shows a 51, and it colors that yellow because when you exceed 50, the particulate can be a bit problematic for people. So that's in that moderate range. When it's less than 50, it categorizes it as green and, you know, not quite as problematic. So Air Visual would be a way to, if the air quality got above 50, that would be a sign that that day windows should stay closed even if it's summer and the air purifier should remain on. Maybe if it drops really low, 20s or, you know, teens, then that would be a great day to air out the home and run fans, keep windows open, and get lots of fresh air in to the home. So I'd recommend the Air Visual app and a good air purifier from the home and a good air purifier from the office. I like IQ Air Health Pro Plus as a choice air purifier. That cannot be afforded because it does cost about $1,000. If you can't afford that, then if the client can't afford that, then the next recommendation is either the Air Doctor or the EnviroCleanse. And the Air Doctor, through Mark Hyman's blog, has a 50% off, which makes it fairly affordable. I think it makes it about $300 or $400. So that would be a recommendation that I would give in a case like this if we were going to be doing a air purifier to try and deal with some of this exhaust fume exposure. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to jot down a couple of these notes and then we can review them for this person at the end when we have complete information. So basically what we have so far is glyphosate slightly elevated, and then we have 2-HIB highly elevated. And I'm assuming that probably the gasoline vapors, since you live in Kansas City, are probably, or exhaust fumes, are probably going to be the main source of this elevation in this person. So do ask and make sure there's not some other reason, like they're working at a gas station or something like that, but typically it's going to be exposure from the air for most people who live in a big city like that. And so then we have the Air Visual app, we have detox supplements and binders. And then we have air purifiers for home and work. And we also want to make sure there's a water purifier as well with BackLife Safe Eden. Okay, so then we go into monoethyl phthalate, MEP, and this one is not elevated, so it's not a concern in this person. Phthalates are in beauty products. It's a lot, is the most common beauty and cosmetic products are the most common sources clinically. So their description is actually pretty good on this one. So you'd really be looking at personal care products if that were elevated. Xylene, we do not see so elevated. People who are painters, you'll often see xylene elevated in. So when people are painters by profession or if they do artistic paint, I make sure they're in a very ventilated area when they do it and they're getting extra glycine. They may even need to wear a mask as well, but that's not the case here. And then we have the next one, we have phenylglyoxylic acid and or PGO. This is basically plastics and plastic manufacturing, also some exhaust fumes from cars and building materials and food packaging. We don't have elevation. I haven't seen a ton of people with elevation in this, but I would be looking at plastics, and this level of elevation for this person is not significant, but I would be thinking car exhaust fumes for this level of elevation because of the 2-HIB elevation. Then we see the N-acetylphenylcysteine, or NAP. That's low in this person, no issues there. So benzene would be the source if that were to be elevated, but not in this case. Cigarette smokers are going to be the most common people you're going to see that elevated in. And then NACE, so again, not an issue in this person, and cigarette smokers will be the main person you'll see that elevated in. Perchlorate, also not elevated in this person, so not going to focus on it here, but something that you would be looking at if it were elevated. And then DPP, so diphenylphosphate here is going to be flame retardant. Often there's a lot of products that are made with flame retardants. And so people who are in manufacturing, they have this elevated, but again, it's not going to be very common. So that could be a work exposure issue if it is elevated. So then we have 2-hydroxoxyethyl mercaptoric HEMA. And so not an issue in this person. And this is also more of an industry specific one. So you're not going to see it that commonly. N-acetylpropylcysteine, or NAPR, is above the 75th percentile for this person, but well below the 95th percentile. As you can see, there's a pretty big gap between 75th and 95th percentile in this one and in some of these, whereas in others of these, there's less of a gap and even less of a gap. So what that means is that there's sort of an extreme difference in some of the amounts, like the high exposure is way, way different than even the you know, 3/4 of the population high exposure. There's dramatic difference for this one. So I think not quite as much of an above 75th percentile when there's this much space between 75th and 95th versus if it's a marker like this where there's not much space between 75th and 95th percentile. So that's one element to pay attention to. And then this is used in cleaning and dry cleaning. Those are going to be the most common things that are going to be exposure. So we're going to want to ask, does it, you know, what does this person use for cleaning? Do they do metal cleaning? Do they use, you know, organic solvents? Are they around dry cleaners a lot? Were they around a dry cleaner shortly before this test? Those are some of the things we're going to want to ask. Treatment's going to be the same in terms of upregulating detoxification pathways and binders. But of course, we want to figure out, is there an ongoing exposure? And if there's an ongoing exposure, we want to know about that and talk through that. So propylene oxide, less than 75th percentile, not significant in this person. NAE is very high here. So I see a note about neighbors smoking in an apartment does come through. And I'm guessing that since cigarette smoke's a source, N-acetyl S2 carbamyl ethyl cysteine that's suspected in this case. There are a couple of the other markers that are associated sometimes with smoking that aren't elevated, but breathing in smoke secondhand from a neighbor is very different than smoking oneself. So this may be related to that. And again, same intervention is going to be recommended where we're going to want to look at air purifier in the home and a very quality air purifier at that, and probably on the side of the home where the neighbors are who smoke. Then we have NADB, not elevated in her case. DMP, not elevated in her case. DEP, between the 75th and 95th. Again, big difference between 75th and 95th in this case. And so this is an issue. This is a very toxic organophosphate. So we do want to pay attention to this. And that is important. So, you know, we're basically, the mechanism here is inhibition of cholinesterase enzymes. And so we are going to want to pay attention to this. Some of the interventions are going to be similar, the detoxification, the binding. See if there's any reason why there might be excessive pesticide exposure, especially talk through the Dirty Dozen and choosing organic for those for sure and others if possible. And then the air purifier may take care of things that are exposed through the cigarette smoke, but we're dealing also potentially with some pesticide exposure as well. So we want to figure out, is there ongoing excessive amounts there? And there may be some genetic reasons why someone doesn't detoxify pesticides as easily as others. So some cytochrome enzymes can be downregulated, which can make for slower detoxification, but we can help change that through some phase one, phase two detoxification upregulators. Okay, so herbicides here, this is low on 2,4-D, this is low on the 3-PBA, this is low on the TG. So, and then DMP is low, DEP is in between the 75th and 95th, but again, big difference. It's not going to be as significant as some of the others, but worth paying some attention to. So diethyl phosphate is another in that list of organophosphate insecticides. So there's some degree of organophosphate issue here. So, you know, in her case, really the overall review here is we're going to be wanting to pay attention to why the glyphosate. We're going to be wanting to pay attention to why the 2-HIB elevation, and we're going to want to be paying attention to some of the supplements, which already they're saying, Great Plains is saying NAC here. I already talked about NAC and glutathione as being two that we're going to want to potentially use. We may want to use some glycine to upregulate some of the liver detoxification pathways, and then some of the binders to bind existing toxin as well. So in terms of some of these things that they're saying here, they're talking a lot about things like N-acetylcysteine and glutathione, in some cases, some B vitamins. And then we get to the organic acids. So first off, takeaways are there's some toxin exposure, not a ton. Seems like most of it's related to some exhaust and or cigarette smoke fumes. And air purification is going to be one of the best interventions, making sure water is pure as well, and making sure that the Dirty Dozen in particular are avoided and pesticides are kept to a minimum. So now the organic acids test. Yeast and fungal markers. So the first several look good. And then we get to arabinose, which is high at 40. That is suggestive of a yeast overgrowth. So we are seeing that there's a yeast overgrowth likely in this case. And this actually brings us to a later question from Nicola, where she asks about ways to test for yeast. And this is one way to test for yeast, is through organic acids and looking at arabinose in particular. Now, all these are yeast markers, so there's also an elevation a bit in the tricarbolylic marker. But the arabinose is probably the number one most commonly elevated and most reliable and most researched of the yeast organic acid markers. It's also on Genova Organics, and it is one that I do see elevated quite a bit, and that is indicative of a fungal overgrowth somewhere. Doesn't specify where. Could be large intestine, could be small intestine, could be skin. You know, you're not sure. But it shows yeast overgrowth, and treatment is similar. So we're going to be looking at an antifungal treatment protocol as part of treatment in this case. And we'll go over putting that together. So that's what the arabinose shows us, and that is a great marker, and that's one that should be paid attention to for yeast overgrowth. Then we have bacterial markers. We have hippuric elevation, and hippuric acid is elevated with bacterial overgrowth. So that can be a sign of bacterial overgrowth. And I don't see a lot of clinical significance to the DHPPA slightly elevated from the beneficial bacteria. It doesn't seem in its optimal place. We could take that to be a possible sign of some dysbiosis, but we're going to be doing work on the gut anyway from the yeast overgrowth, and so it's not that valuable of an addition for us to know that. But the hippuric acid elevation is, that does tell us that there could be some indication for us to be looking at not only antifungal but also antibacterial. So antimicrobial / bacterial from the puric elevation. We may be looking at something like a small intestinal bacterial and small intestinal fungal overgrowth in this case. Then we see an elevation here that's still in range but elevated out of the majority of people in the HPHPA. So probably on, you know, when we get to in the 3-indole acetate, when we get to that are outside of the most common window that's in the middle here, even if it's not high or low outside of range, if it is outside of the bar in the center of the range, we want to pay some attention to that. So we want to pay some attention to HPHPA and 3-indole acetate, sorry, 3-indole acetic acid. So those are clostridial related markers. So we want to consider doing, we're already doing antimicrobial, but we want to consider a clostridial focus through Saccharomyces boulardii to help with if there are any toxin, C. diff toxins that we can help to eliminate them, and especially if there's also diarrhea or loose stool as a pattern in this case. Then we see that glyceric acid is just slightly below the bar, but barely. Again, so this is an oxalate metabolite. I'm not going to pay a lot of attention or recommend a low oxalate diet or anything like that, unless I see these way off or, you know, really high. So then we see but unless there's a kidney stone issue, if there's kidney stone issue, I'll pay more attention to this. Glycolytic cycle metabolites, we have, you know, functionally slightly below where it would be expected for lactic acid. Pyruvic is bottom of what we would expect. And so these are going to be, again, not super significant and not going to change what we're going to do already anyway based on these other markers. We do have formaric and malic acids to be a little high. I see a note about L-carnitine and alpha-lipoic acid here. We do see for sure out of range the 2-oxoglutaric acid, and then the citric is getting close there. So overall mitochondrial support is indicated in this case. And when I say overall mitochondrial support, I will give you what I mean when we go through the treatment, but as a brief overview, the four core elements of that are CoQ10 or ubiquinol with carnitine, alpha-lipoic acid, and also the addition of, on top of those three, I like a B vitamin, a good active B vitamin, and I like some people do D-ribose, and sometimes I'll combine a carnitine with D-ribose, but I don't feel that D-ribose is super crucial, but I do like N-acetylcysteine in almost every case. So N-acetylcysteine, alpha-lipoic acid, carnitine, and CoQ10 or ubiquinol are the core four that I would be including for mitochondrial markers. So we'll, again, get more specific with that when we go into treatment. And then additional mitochondrial markers on amino acid metabolites, we have elevations here on 3-methylglutaric acid and 3-hydroxyglutaric acid. So additional pointers that we need some mitochondrial support, and that may be helpful, especially since energy is a chief complaint. Mitochondria, of course, are the energy centers for the cells and that cellular energy. So we really want to address that. Then on neurotransmitter metabolites, we see slightly functional lows on quinolinic and kynurenic acid. I'm not going to make big deal out of those. The 5-HIAA, I'm going to consider, hey, maybe some 5-HTP. I'm going to consider that as a loose maybe, but it might not hit the priority list because these aren't huge, huge out of range things here. And the thiamine, same deal. We do have a clear high on 3-hydroxybutyric under ketone and fatty acid oxidation. We also have a high on methylsuccinic and a high on suberic. And carnitine we already talked about in the context of using it for mitochondrial support, but this strengthens that we'll also want it for prevention of fatty acid oxidation. So carnitine is going to be a significant player here. Then methylmalonic acid being in that even high normal range, I do want to think about B12 injections with fatigue and that methylmalonic acid level. So we'll talk through that as well. Make a note about fatty acid oxidation so that we can review when we talk through treatment. And then we see that riboflavin or vitamin B2 is, you know, above the optimal functionally. So, and these ones that have the asterisk basically means that high means low, so high here means low amounts. So B2 could use a little bit more, and vitamin C could use a little bit more. You'll see that CoQ10 here looks like it's okay. It's in normal range, and I wonder if she's taking it or if it's just in normal range, but for mitochondrial support, I'm probably going to recommend taking some anyway if she's not already. And N-acetylcysteine, of course, we're going to want to take some of that. Already mentioned and talked about that. And then biotin, in that functionally low, and because biotin has some antifungal, biotin may be included in our antifungal protocol. And then pyroglutamic acid here, functionally low in this range, but usually high is what is more indicative of a glutathione deficiency. This is telling me that, hey, let's not use glutathione directly necessarily. Probably N-acetylcysteine is going to be enough when we see this N-acetylcysteine dropped out like that. And then we see the 2-hydroxybutyric in the high normal range. That's telling me that probably N-acetylcysteine will be sufficient, and we won't necessarily need to add liposomal or oral glutathione on top of that. Ammonia looks fine. Aspartate looks fine. The 2-hydroxyhippuric acid indicator of aspartame, salicylates, or GI bacteria. That looks fine. Then we have 2-hydroxyisovaleric and 2-oxoisovaleric bottomed out, as well as 2-hydroxyisocuproic here. These ones are ones that in most cases, most of these ones are problems if they're high and not if they're low. So they aren't normal, but they're not necessarily as big an issue as if we saw them to be high. So we're not necessarily going to add anything different in terms of treatment based on these results in the amino acid metabolites here, but we'll be adding some amino acids for liver detoxification purposes. Mineral metabolism in general and the phosphoric is, you know, in that functionally low range. Again, may not hit the priority list for us, but if there are bone density issues, we may want to add something that includes some phosphorus in it. And so then that looks like all the results. So what we're going to do here is flip over to a treatment plan for this patient. Okay, so here are my brief notes that I've gotten started with in this case, which is that glyphosate was slightly elevated, 2-HIB was highly elevated, possibly from gasoline vapor, and that for the toxic burden side of things, we're thinking the AirVisual app is a great thing for her to be aware of. So when we're looking at intervention here, so we'll just bullet point list here, AirVisual app and air out house only when under 50 and better if under 25 for when windows are open and the house is airing out. Purchase an air purifier of high quality for the home and the office. IQ Air Health Plus Pro or Health Pro Plus. I don't sometimes confuse those. So if it's not Health Pro Plus, it's Health Plus Pro. And then for Air Doctor through Mark Hyman's blog, if IQ Air is not affordable, or Enviro Cleanse, especially if there is need or desire for the having a ultraviolet UV light on top of air purification. Now, there are other decent filters, Boston Air makes a couple decent filters, and so these aren't the only ones, but these are just the ones that tend to be my go-to recommendations. And I'm going to say, especially use air purifier in the bedroom when sleeping and near the wall with the neighbor who smokes. Make sure purified water or spring water is being consumed and the water filter is adequate. And then add some detox supplements outlined below. Then avoid 30 dozen foods that are non-organic. Focus on clean 15 as the ones to let slide, and ideally everything else organic. And the EWG or Environmental Working Group has an app and a great website to overview this. Okay, next we want to put together an antifungal protocol. So let's go protocol. So we want N-acetylcysteine, and we want about 1800 milligrams twice daily. Away from meals is preferable so we can get some biofilm activity out of it. But with meals is okay too because we're going to get the glutathione that way. You just won't get quite as much antibiofilm out of it. And so NAC twice daily away from meals. And then we can either do something along the lines of amino detox, which is a Designs for Health supplement that has some various amino acids for detoxification. That's an option, but what I'm going to do actually is I'm going to put that in brackets because my inclination is we're going to get a little heavy in our supplements for all of this stuff, and we may not want to include that. We may instead just want to add in some glycine for a combination of detoxification and methylation and collagen formation. And I'd prefer to have glycine, which could be done either as a supplement at 3 grams, 3 times daily, twice with meals and once before bed, or collagen protein can provide glycine needs at 20 to 30 grams per day. Then we're going to look at an NRF2, especially since mold is also a concern. So I would look at nano-emulsified DIM by Quicksilver at 4 pumps once daily. And that's really going to help to open that NRF2 pathway and help to open the body's capacity to appropriately detoxify. Then what we're going to do next is we're going to add a binder. And in this case, I'm going to do, so this case we're suspecting mold. We don't have the TGF beta 1 now, but you know, I'm going to say if TGF beta 1 elevation, use 3 to 4 binders. Now can start with 2 binders, and you want 3 to 4 binders 4 times daily. So now we're going to start with 2. For now, start with activated charcoal, 2 caps, 3 times daily, 1 hour before or 2 hours after other food / med / supplements, also except binders, which you can take together with each other. Also, GI detox, 2 caps, 3 times daily, taken together with charcoal. It actually has a little bit of charcoal in it, but it's more a clay. So that's going to be 2 binders to also help with the toxic burden. Then we're going to have an antifungal protocol. So let's do 5,000 micrograms biotin once daily with meals. And then let's do intestable 3 caps twice daily or other oil of oregano supplement. So intestable is a nice one. Also candecidyl by Zymogen is another good one as an alternative. So intestable or candicidal, going to be two great oil of oregano with a few other oils and anti-candida things. MCT oil, 1 tablespoon once daily with meals to have the caprylic acid as an anti-biofilm. And we're going to add some berberine of some sort. So I really like berbamycin, physimogen, 4 caps twice daily in this case. Berberine complex by Integrative Therapeutics is an alternative. And I might add in some lauricidin, which is antifungal and antimicrobial. At 1.5 scoops twice daily with meals. And then I would add in Saccharomyces boulardii at 10 billion twice daily, usually 2 caps twice daily, will get you that dosage. Now, it would be good to give or get some, I would do a active B complex, something like that, by Zymogen is a great one. So I would do some sort of B complex so that you can get the B needs, and I would have the person trial B12 injections, probably 10 milligrams methylcobalamin weekly for 4 weeks to see if energy improves dramatically. And if it does, continue weekly for 12 weeks, then space to every other week, 12 weeks, then monthly for maintenance. If you can't find methylcobalamin, cyanocobalamin, it's not ideal, but it's worth it because B12 injections can make such a massive difference for people. So if they can only find cyanocobalamin injections, go ahead and do it. Preferably methylcobalamin or hydroxycobalamin is going to be a little better if possible. Sometimes people can get a script from their doctor for methylcobalamin and do it themselves as well. So that's really going to take care of the antifungal, the antimicrobial, and the clostridial, plus some of the detox. Now we just need the mitochondrial support and maybe some vitamin C. So for mitochondrial support, we already have the N-acetylcysteine. So now we'll add L-carnitine, 500 milligrams twice daily with meals. And we'll add, and that could be acetyl L-carnitine. And then we're going to add ubiquinol, 200 milligrams once daily. And then we're going to add RLA, 300 milligrams once daily. That's R-lipoic acid. It's like alpha-lipoic acid, but the more bioavailable form, Geronova is a great brand for that. Or alternatively, you can use ALA from another brand. Also, at 300 milligrams daily, it's a little more bioavailable to do the RLA, but 300 milligrams is still a decent dose for R-lipoic acid. or alpha-lipoic acid, even though our lipoic is a little more bioavailable. It's a preference, but alpha-lipoic of 300 is still decent. You could go a little higher than that. I wouldn't go a ton higher than that for a long time, but 300 milligrams alpha-lipoic or R-lipoic would be great in the context of that mitochondrial support. So, in addition to that, you can consider 3 times weekly or more sauna can be helpful on detox, followed by skin brushing in shower. And that can be a great addition on the detoxification piece. In terms of the energy, I think your best bets for energy are going to come here from the active B complex down to the RLA and the B12 injections being the number one possibility or likelihood for getting the energy to get back to an optimal level. And I'd add the NAC here for the mitochondrial support as well. So these plus NAC are going to be for the chief complaint, but the gut issues are going to help in the long run as well. And I think it's important to do those gut things probably for about 60 days or so based on symptom changes. So there we go. This gives you a solid sense for how to work with this client and this case. So let's move on to the next. Oh, and just to clarify on Marcon's testing, the lab that does Marcon's testing may give an account to nutritionists. I don't know. It'd be worth checking with them. And people may be able to order direct themselves as well. Again, I'm not 100% sure on that because we do order for patients in our clinic, but I would go ahead and check with them. It's microbiology is the name of the lab there. So do check with microbiology lab to see if you can get an account. And or refer people to order directly for Marcon's nasal swabs. I'll warn you that the instructions for how to do the Marcon's nasal swab show putting the going into the upper sinus cavity this way. I do not recommend that. I recommend just going slightly in, rotating, and then pushing straight back so that you're going deep, 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 deep into the sinus cavity. Hit the back wall. It's a little bit uncomfortable, but if you have congestion, you need to push through that, get to that back wall, do a little twist, and then pull it out. It should go in a few inches. So I do recommend going to that back wall. There are some YouTube videos that explain that and can show you an example of how to do that. Okay, I think that answers this one. So on to the next. So this is a question: what is a healthy level of NAGLase? HDRI says 0.32 to 0.95 reference range. Read online, healthy level is less than 0.65. I have a client who tested 1.26 in October. Latest result was 0.94. Is So it's come down, but slow process of getting into the healthy range. Plan to continue with antiviral supplementation to lower that level further. Which nagulase level should I be targeting? I like 0.8 as a target for nagulase, which is kind of between the 0.65 that you're talking about, that you read about online, and the 0.95 HDRI reference range. 0.8 seems to be a healthy medium to me in terms of not being so overly rigid to be potentially pushing people further down than they need to be in terms of your treatment, but also getting people into a functional zone of health. And unless there's reason for feeling like a person's immunocompromised for other reasons, I like 0.8 as a marker. So I wouldn't use the 0.65 unless there are other reasons to do so. And 0.8 is my recommendation. So I would keep going for a little bit longer and target 0.8 as the goal and see if you can get it to go down. Great job on having it go down the amount that it has already. In the November Q&A, we talked about high TGF-beta-1 in relation to mold illness and also mentioned that other things can cause TGF-beta-1 to increase. And so what are the other things? So some of the other things, there's a great article on Self-Hacked that reviews some of the research. And I believe I had pulled it up before. So let's get this pulled up here. It's not pulling up. I'll just manually put it into this. This is a very nice article at selfhack.com/blog/TGF. And it's got a ton of information, but I'm going to scroll down to the things that can increase TGF-beta-1. So hypoxia or low oxygen here, one of the reasons for low oxygen can be mold toxin causing hypoxia in the brain, but there can be other reasons for hypoxia. For example, sleep apnea. So when considering low oxygen causing TGF-beta increase, we do need to consider mold illness, or we also need to consider other causes of hypoxia like sleep apnea as well. Psychological stress. So stress, gosh, about makes everything a little bit worse, including TGF-beta-1. So we need to think about stress, and we need to think about stress, especially if we know that a person's adrenals are an issue or cortisol is dysregulated, or we know they've been under extra stress. And our entire culture is plagued with a lot of stress, so we should consider stress as one thing that could be increasing it. Wounds and burns. There's been a recent wound or burn. We want to consider that as a possibility. SIRT1. So resveratrol may, if they're taking supplemental resveratrol, that may raise TGF-beta-1 levels. Pregnenolone may raise TGF-beta-1 levels. Growth hormone may raise TGF-beta-1 levels. 5-HT2A receptor drugs may increase TGF-beta levels. Estrogen, they're taking hormone replacement, can increase TGF in the skin. T3, if they're on a thyroid replacement with T3, that can increase it. Cigarette smoke can increase it. Progesterone, again, hormone replacement. Somatostatins, if they're on a statin, mast cells, so if there's mast cell activation and histamine issues, interferon, which is a drug for hepatitis, Saccharomyces boulardii in chicks was shown. I haven't seen this to be significant in people, and also Bacillus subtilis, which is a soil-based organism in chicks, can increase TGF-beta. Again, haven't seen it to be a significant variable for people in our, for patients in our clinic, but good to know that S. boulardii and soil-based probiotics could have a small impact on TGF-beta. Artemisinin, which we do use in the clinic sometimes for treatment for parasites or for co-infections like babesia, that could increase TGF-beta in the spleen cells. Angiotensin II, so, you know, blood pressure-related medication may impact beta-2 adrenoreceptor agonists also, and then endoplasmic reticulum stress. So this is things that can increase TGF-beta, and the most significant is hypoxia, and then psychologic stress is important to evaluate for. And then if someone is doing hormone replacement, you want to consider that, or if they've had a recent wound or burn, and some medications may impact it. Seems like cigarette smoke impacts a lot of things, and for a lot of reasons is very significantly problematic. So that should give you a sense on the TGF-beta, and you can check out that article for even more info on that. So now we have a female, 51, chief complaint of fatigue, extreme fatigue, started in 2011. Has been feeling much better since 2017, past year. She's felt great up until 2 weeks ago when fatigue had been much stronger again. So tested some of her issues, found some problems, have some labs. Done a lot to reduce stress toxins, improve diet, greatly improved life so she can heal. Paleo-ish diet, whole foods, good carbs, knowledgeable on diet. Not much role of stress, not much role of mental, emotional, spiritual because she's been working there. And we did discuss some in the October question and answer on low thyroid antibodies, iron deficiency, adrenal issues, and those have been addressed now. High NAGLase from suspected EBV and gut issues. Treated SIBO recently, tested negative for SIBO. Congrats on that. Recent stool test indicated candida dysbiosis and carbohydrate malabsorption. Suspect leaky gut as well, since she does have thyroid antibodies sometimes. And tested IgE, IgG reactions in June, a lot of food sensitivities, allergens. Doing a candida protocol, want to do a leaky gut healing once candida is gone. Dutch complete in March was okay, indicated low thyroid. Looked at it in one of the Q&A calls. Tested negative for antiparietal cell antibodies, which was mentioned in the October call. Great for testing on that since that's a significant player for fatigue in many cases, and 20 to 40% chances of that being positive for people with thyroid, but not in this case, it sounds like. Currently taking standard process thytrophin, PMG, and selenium for thyroid. Was taking iodine since May 2018. Tested iodine and found it was low based on the urine test, but stopped. September 2018 as it looked like it was driving thyroid up too much. Also stopped taking standard processed ferrofood iron supplement in September, so iron went too high after taking it. From April, May 2018, interesting to note that she felt great over the summer, and presumably thyroid and iron were doing well. Due to these supplements, I think we may have just overshot those, which explains September results on those. We are supplementing and working on the viral infection. NAGLase has decreased over the past year. Questions are, plan to add trace minerals with 150 milligrams iodine to continue the thytrophin PMG and selenium for thyroid. Should she be doing anything else differently on the thyroid front? So we'll look at the labs and then answer that. And then I want to put her back on iron to see if it helps with fatigue and raise ferritin. Do you agree? Should I be concerned that it will increase iron too much? So we'll talk about that. And then how often to retest for thyroid and iron? Phlebotomist recently told me retesting often builds up a lot of scar tissue at the veins and can cause problems getting a needle further down the line. I'd like to avoid that. And then would I be concerned about these changes in LDL and HDL or about the low cholesterol level overall? She has low total cholesterol for as long as she can remember. In April 2018, ApoB was 52, so in range. And is there anything else? So let's go ahead and switch over to those labs. Okay, so here we go. We had looked at them previously through September, but we're adding here the December. So TSH, which had been 0.01 in September, went to 1.98, which is still in the optimal range. The free T3 went from 4.9, which was a little smidge high, to 2.2. which is lower than we'd like to see it. So we do want to add in here some things. So the trace minerals, I think for sure, is a good addition here, especially since it seems like the iodine previously had helped to get that free T3 up. And free T4 had gone a little low as well, which is also another indicator that iodine is appropriate because iodine tends to get T4 and T3 up, whereas if it's a conversion issue, that's more along the lines of selenium. So iodine is going to be probably a key role in a low dose in this case. Then we did not have a reverse T3. Thyroglobulin antibodies were fine. TPO antibodies were fine. So basically, I do agree that iodine is appropriate and probably beneficial in this case. And I would start with 150 milligrams and potentially go up to 600 milligrams, micrograms, 150 micrograms. Potentially go up to 600 micrograms. I wouldn't, unless there's reason to in this case, go above 600 micrograms. So I would go ahead and stick with that range of 150 to 600. For trace minerals, I would just do one cap for the 150 micrograms. If you're going to add additional, I might add one drop of a liquid iodine that's maybe 300 or 400 micrograms, and you could do kelp capsules instead of that, which are going to vary, but often have 150-ish micrograms per cap. And if so, you could start by adding one cap for a few weeks and then one more cap for a few weeks. But I like one cap of trace minerals for 3 weeks, see how it's doing, and then retest in 3 to 4 weeks to see where those thyroid numbers are at. Ferritin level did drop down to 18, which is too low, and I would recommend taking some iron supplements. The thing, though, is that the iron... Okay, so why is iron still high with low ferritin? So ferritin's a storage form of iron. The fact that iron is a little high is actually not a bad thing. In fact, it's probably a good thing, showing that the body is trying to put more into storage. Now, if you get an iron saturation, that can give you a little more of a sense for what's going on with that. But without an iron, without a transferrin saturation percentage, all I can say is probably what's happening is that the body is pushing more iron into storage form. And I wouldn't be concerned at this point because ferritin's the majority of iron and the serum iron level is really a very small percentage, very small percentage of the total iron in the body. So I would not be concerned with that being just slightly high at 167. In terms of supplementing versus getting it from food, that's going to depend. What I might recommend trialing if you haven't already is using a digestive enzyme supplement that also has betaine HCl and increasing red meat consumption to see if those iron levels can go up. Now, we're obviously not worried about the saturated fat and cholesterol, with cholesterol being 165. I don't consider that too low. I consider below 150 to be starting to be concerning. 165 I consider to be just fine. And okay, so it looks like she already takes Zypan with HCl and enzymes, eats some red meat, but not a whole lot. How about liver? Is she consuming any liver? No liver. So how does she take one Zypan per meal? Have she tried different doses? Doesn't sound like she'll eat liver. She takes two Zypan per meal. So once SIBO is eliminated, often iron comes up. Was SIBO eliminated long before this December test, or had it just been eliminated? So tested SIBO in September. So there was a little bit of time. For October, okay. So there's a little bit of time after SIBO had been eliminated prior to this blood test, but what I would recommend is have probably ideally one meal per day with red meat and or shellfish that have high amounts of iron, and potentially add an extra Zypan in on those meals to better absorb that iron as well. And what I would do is I'd try and tease apart the energy a bit with supplemental iron versus supplemental iodine for the thyroid. So I wouldn't do both at once. What I'd do is I'd add the trace mineral for iodine for 3 weeks while recommending daily red meat consumption with an extra Zypan on each of those red meat, or alternatively shellfish if she prefers something like clam. Clams have very high amounts of iron, so she could do a serving of clam or red meat. And then see if the iron can build a bit that way without an iron supplement, and see if the energy changes from more the thyroid intervention of adding the iodine in. And then I would do 3 to 4 weeks of retest, both of ferritin and of the thyroid markers, to see if the thyroid has improved and see if the iron is heading in the right direction as a result of having done some of that intervention on SIBO and having the increased amount of iron in the diet. And a saturated fat associated with the red meat shouldn't be a concern with the cholesterol levels that she's got. And I don't think it's too low at 165, even though HDL is flagged as a little low at 58. But I would suggest some saturated fat consumption of the healthy kinds of saturated fat like grass-fed butter, ghee, grass-fed red meat and coconut oil. So I would suggest increasing those in the diet in order to help to bring the healthful cholesterol levels up. And because saturated fat's shown typically to raise overall cholesterol a little bit for most people, but HDL more than LDL. So, and no increased cardiovascular disease risk for most people on average. So that's what I would do on the cholesterol front. And with a B12 of 529 and supplementing B12, I would recommend trialing B12 injections. So I would recommend 10 milligrams B12 methylcobalamin weekly for 4 weeks to assess for whether B12 injections might offer additional benefit, even though she didn't have antiparietal cell antibodies positive. A low 500s with a B12 supplement is suspicious, because I want to see it 500 or greater without a B12 supplement to feel good about the metabolism of B12. So you could increase the dosage by doing a 10 milligram sublingual B12 and or B12 injections, which sometimes have dramatically different effects from supplemental. But what I'd recommend is consider a 10 milligram sublingual and or injection of B12. If you're doing sublingual, I'd do that daily, 10 milligrams. If you're doing injection, I'd do that once per week for 4 weeks as a trial to see how she does with 10 milligrams of B12 as an injectable. And if that makes a huge difference energy-wise, that may be advisable to do more for 12 weeks, followed by spacing it to every other week, followed by spacing it to once a month. So trace minerals for iodine for 3 to 4 weeks, followed by a blood test to repeat and see where things are at, together with adding an additional Zypam with a red meat meal on each day of the week, or having shellfish and seeing if that's enough alone to touch the iron levels, and then add the saturated fats that are healthy for the cholesterol side of things. And I would start the intervention there. And there is additional stuff that you can do for thyroid, but I don't necessarily think it's needed in this case. And by doing the gut work and the Candida protocol and then a leaky gut protocol, I think you're actually going to make a difference there, probably with the thyroid, plus doing the antiviral treatment that you mentioned and some of the other work. You did get thyroid to be in the high normal range. So what I would recommend is see if the iodine's enough and see if the red meat with an extra Zypam's enough on the iron, and see if increased healthful saturated fats can balance out that cholesterol a little bit in terms of raising that HDL. And that's where I would go from here. Let me just check what additional questions, in case I missed any. And then, yeah, I do think it's a good idea to continue with the thytrophin, PMG, and selenium. But what I would do is I would think about more iodine than 150 micrograms if on the next blood test in 3 to 4 weeks you haven't achieved more than a free T3 of 3. Free T3 is still less than 3, and free T4 is still in the low normal range. I would then increase the iodine to 300 micrograms for a few weeks, and then maybe even 450 or 600 for a few weeks and then retest again. And then on the retesting question with the phlebotomist talking about building up of scar tissue at the veins and causing problems getting a needle in further down the line, that's not a big concern for if you're doing every other month blood testing while doing intensive treatment. It's totally worth it. I don't think that's a big concern. I recommend people with high iron getting, you know, blood draws as regularly as every 2 or 3 months for the rest of their life. And, you know, it's generally not an issue. So sure, yes, it could build up a little bit of scar tissue, but if they're going to a skilled phlebotomist, it shouldn't build up a lot of scar tissue, and it shouldn't cause big problems later on. I know some people's veins are really hard to find, and then that can involve multiple sticks each time. And that gets a little tricky to assess, but in general, I feel like it's completely appropriate to do regular blood tests, you know, as much as every month and sometimes every 2 to 3 months while doing treatment for complex chronic issues. And I think it's totally worth it. And then the LDL, HDL changes, I'm not overtly concerned, but I would, you know, just consider making sure that fats are adequate, especially healthy saturated fats. And then in terms of anything else thinking of or doing, just the B12, increasing the dose of the sublingual or trialing injections would be the next additional thing to do. But it sounds like you've been great, doing great. She had a period of feeling great, and really it's more honing, tweaking, refining, how can we get her back to that, and identify what specifically is getting her back to that, which is why I like the idea of isolating the iron supplementation from the iodine supplementation so that we can get clear on which it is that's having the bigger effect in her case. And then also considering that B12 may be another variable. So that should do it on this case. And looks like we have one last question here. So what do we recommend to test Candida? We talked earlier about the arabinose organic acids test. So the organics dysbiosis test will look at some yeast markers, and the Great Plains organic acids test will look at some of the markers associated with yeast and Candida. Stool, especially the doctor's data stool test, is a great one. The microscopic yeast and then also the MALDI looks at the species and identifying the species and does a culture and sensitivity for them. Like that test a lot. So that's a great one for yeast. That's more yeast in the large intestine. And then there are Candida antibodies that you can get through a typical blood test like LabCorp, where you can look at IgG antibodies to Candida. You can look at IgG and IgM if you want. IgG is the most, it's good to do a panel. So it's good to do IgG and IgM together, antibodies for Candida. And those can be done through a lab like LabCorp. So that's another way to consider on retesting it. So if you do another stool test, one way to save on that from doing the whole CDSA is if it was microscopic yeast that came up, you could just do a you could just order that. I don't know if you can order that as a standalone. You have to look at doctor's data, but I know you can order a parasitology times three as a standalone. I believe they do microscopy for yeast on that. And that is a lot cheaper than the full CDSA. So that can be a good savings if you're just looking for yeast under the microscope. They'll look for parasites too, but you know, your target will be the yeast that you had found previously. So what I'd recommend on a retest for a savings for the patient is to consider doing just a parasitology times three and not the full CDSA in order to get that savings on the price point. And that's going to be the best way to retest if you found it on a stool test initially, because the blood doesn't always correlate with the stool and you don't have a baseline blood test, but you could do organic acids or blood as a different testing mechanism if you wanted to get a different perspective. I don't think you need to. I'd recommend probably going parasitology for the microscopy looking for yeast as a follow-up. And you don't have to retest yeast if there have been a decrease in symptoms and you know SIBO's already gotten better and you're continuing immune support, because yeast really, it's opportunistic and it does tend to elevate in the presence of other issues like SIBO and immunodeficiency and chronic viral infections. And if you're doing immune support, if you've treated for antiviral things, if you've treated with getting rid of small intestinal bacterial overgrowth and symptoms have gotten better, I don't think you necessarily have to retest for it. So I would judge it in part based on the symptoms. And if everything's great, I wouldn't bother with a retest personally, unless the person wants it for peace of mind. And then, of course, it's their choice. All righty, that is a wrap. Thank y'all for attending and watching. Hope you've enjoyed this. I do think we've gone a long time, so I'm not going to say too much more about the meditation retreat other than that I highly, highly recommend for you personally as practitioners to lead by example and do intensive meditation practice. First, establish a daily practice for yourself. That's really, really important. Even if you only get 5 minutes in, it's better in research. If you look at 20, 40 minutes, that's better. I'd recommend that. But even 5 minutes, get in the habit, do it every day. And then go to a retreat. That training will take your meditation to a much higher level. I feel like one of the things post 36-day retreat is that what took me about 15 minutes to achieve in terms of depth and expansiveness in my state is down to less than 5 minutes now when I'm doing meditation, and I've been back more than a couple of weeks. So it's persisting with me. And that's one of the big things that I find from going on intensive retreat-like processes is that you'll get this jump in level of ability to go deep. Now, if you don't already have a daily practice, you may not really understand what that means, but I'll tell you that depth is incredibly important. And a beginning meditator who thinks, I can't meditate, I'm just sitting there thinking all the time. Well, first of all, if you're aware of your thoughts, that's already meditation. So the fact that you're thinking all the time, if you're aware of that and of what those thoughts are and that those thoughts are happening, that's already meditation. You're already actually doing the process. Awareness of thoughts is already a meditation. You want to also have awareness of body and breath eventually, but a beginning of awareness of thought is already a beginning. So first of all, I'll say that. Secondly, as you go deeper, there are unbelievable states possible. I mean, I've experienced all sorts of wild things in meditation, states of bliss that parallel orgasm, incredible feelings of expansiveness, deep, deep peacefulness and tranquility, complete contentment, feelings of being very, very expansive and looking down at the body feeling small, feelings of spinning, feelings of having a jolt in the body, feelings of things being activated in the brain, like electrical bursts of sensation in one area and then burst of sensation in another area and then burst of sensation in another area, feelings of adjustments in the bones, in the skull, and positioning of the brain. Just amazing, very interesting and incredible things, incredible experiences, inspirations, realizations, like, wow, I've been doing this thing that's been getting in the way of my enjoying my life, or inspirations about work or patients or my own health issues, things that come up over time. I've received significant benefit and guidance and inspiration through meditation. So I very strongly recommend you have the experience of going to meditation retreats. And, you know, you can start with just a weekend. That's great to start with a weekend. And then work your way up and find 5-day, 7-day, 14-day, month-long retreats. Those make a massive difference in capacity to be able to regulate stress in the long run and to be more resilient over time. And if you're interested in evolution, if you're interested in developing yourself, cultivating yourself as a person, cultivating your personal relationships, cultivating your business, cultivating your ability to be happy and enjoy your life, to reduce your suffering, I know of nothing better than meditation retreats and regular daily practice and applying that practice into your day-to-day life. I know nothing better than that to achieve personal development, cultivation, and growth. It outweighs any amount of intellectual, cognitive learning you could ever do. Cognitive understandings are helpful and important, and it's good to go to classes that are more cognitive and more focused, but go to trainings that are actually experiential too, like a retreat. They're a whole different animal. And learning conceptually is good, it helps, it's interesting, it's fascinating. But training experientially offers a whole different level of benefit that grows and grows and grows and grows with time. And for the long run, training is extremely important. And you reach a point where you have enough cognitive understanding to where the returns on additional cognitive understanding are limited. But the returns on experiential training, I don't know of a point at which they become limited or obsolete. They're just really, really a lifelong process. So I'm going to continue to go, I plan on for the rest of my life, to meditation retreats, and highly encourage you to consider doing the same. So please take advantage of the retreats that we're offering, and also check out and find out about other retreats. And if you're interested in finding out more from us about retreats that we're doing or retreats that we're hearing about or knowing about or recommending, please get in contact with us. And I'll tell you right now that shengzhen.org, shengzhen.org, that's where my teacher, Li Jun Feng, where his classes are highly recommend his retreats. So that's one resource for you, to go to shengzhen.org, shengzhen.org, and look at the events there that are coming up, and then also get in contact with us, and I'm happy to share more. So thank you so much for joining for this evening, and have a wonderful evening, and we will chat with you soon. Please keep submitting your questions and keep on doing the great work of ending and reversing chronic diseases and helping to end the chronic disease epidemic. This is deeply needed work. Thank you all so much. Take care.